thank you all for coming. Before I introduce the panel, I'd just like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of this land, and pay my respects to elders both past and present. Thanks for coming. We have a distinguished panel. Of course, by definition, all panels at Lowy are distinguished, but I mean it. Very briefly, from left, Adam Nee from the ANU, Su Lin Tan from the Australian Financial Review, Jason Lee from Vantage Group Asia, and Marie Ma from Vision Times. Now, obviously, apart from me, it's an entirely Chinese-Australian panel, which might look like a bit like a gimmick or an artifice. But if you think, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking that Chinese-Australians are portrayed in this debate about, you know, Chinese party state influence operations. Chinese-Australians have been portrayed as both the perpetrators of influence operations, the victims of them, the target of them, the enablers of them. So it's a kind of messy, irreconcilable portrayal. And when I was putting this panel together, you know, there were various people suggested to me, some suggested to me as kind of community leaders. And I was sort of turned off by a description of community leader because I think the Chinese community in Australia, it's their views, their antecedents are quite diverse, and I hope that's going to be reflected here tonight. So what I'm going to do is just go through with each of the panelists and have a short chat about various aspects of this debate. Then we'll have a more open discussion, and then we'll get questions from the audience. I'm going to start with Adam. Adam was one of the organisers, in fact, the prime organiser of the second of two letters, public letters put out mainly by academics on this issue, about how one should speak about Chinese party state influence operations, actually often called Chinese influence operations, so-called. And Adam, that letter said that this debate was valuable, necessary, essential to intellectual freedom, democratic rights, and national security. Now, briefly, tell me what you meant by that. I mean, that's quite strong language.
Right, sure. I think one of the first things that we have to understand is that China is growing very powerful internationally. And one of the things that it's trying to do is to influence countries in our region, including Australia. So there's a lot of evidence for Chinese influence and interference activities in Australia. From my perspective, I think we need to understand what are the most harmful of these activities and respond to Beijing as part of the recalibration of the relationship to draw a line and say that certain activities that harm democratic rights and erode our institutions and potentially social harmony would not be accepted. So that's the reason why we felt the need to put out that letter and state the position that this debate is very important and it needs to be done in such a way that is not self-censored.
So one of the things that people often come back with, they say, well, you know, there's every country tries to seek public opinion, there's the Israel lobby, so-called. You know, the US takes people to you know, travel there. It's, in other words, it's done across the board. What is different about China or the Chinese government or the Communist Party? Why should we care more about that than other countries?
Okay, so put simply, there's a difference between influence and interference, where there is every country obviously seeks to influence, but not every country does it covertly, in a way that some of the Chinese activities, the PRC activities, can be seen. So that's one important difference. The other difference is that I believe actions are not independent of actors. So if you have actor A and actor B, and they have very different histories and beliefs, then their actions mean very different things. So in this specific case, we have a China that is led by one party, a China that is hugely consequential to Australia and Australia's role in the world, a country that in recent years under Xi Jinping has gone backward in terms of human rights and space for civil liberty. So I think we need to be extremely vigilant about the activities of such a party state in Australia and more broadly in our region.
Thanks. Jason, I want to bring you in here. You've been critical of some of the way this debate's been conducted. I think you were critical of the Four Corners report, for example. And in one thing you wrote, you complained about the absence of any united response from the community, which in turn speaks to the profound lack of Chinese-Australian influence in Australia. Could you expand on that, what your criticism of the debate is and why you think the response of the community has been so poor?
Thanks, Richard. I think this is the big irony of this whole sort of debate. I kind of think it's precisely because Chinese in Australia, however you define that, profoundly lack political influence that the debate has unfolded in the way that it has. Now, I don't disagree with what Adam said. If there are covert, coercive, underhand things that are unacceptable that is happening, absolutely they should be dealt with. However, they need to be dealt with in a way that doesn't arouse distrust and suspicion and doesn't play to populism. Because when you do that, you disenfranchise and you discourage Chinese Australians from getting involved in the debate. And I mean, this panel is sort of, you know, in some ways my personal coming out, you know, on this issue. I mean, I've been in the biggest funk about this.
I had to talk Jason into coming on.
I've been in the biggest funk about this issue because it's so important and it's so personal. And I just couldn't think through it. And I rang Simon Longstaff, who's my neighbour, and I said, Simon, I'm really struggling with this. I can't think clearly about this. Can you sit with me and talk me through this? And he did, and he helped me through a series of questions in that terrific Simon Longstaff way, just unpack all of this. And it made me realise, look, I've have a history of being quite vocal on issues, particularly when they do with race. And if I can't find my voice on this one, then how do a lot of other Chinese Australians feel? And maybe that is the reason why there's been so few Chinese voices in this debate. And that's exactly the dangerous thing about the way, not the content, the way this debate has been prosecuted.
Well, one more question to you. Well, I've only been moved back to Australia after being away for a long time, and I often hear, and I don't, you know, where people from saying from various podiums, we are the greatest multicultural country in the world. But then you, I think one of your lines was, and this relates to how this debate is carried out, when does a migrant stop being Chinese and start being Australian? I mean, are we still struggling with that?
But it's really hard. When you think about some of the people who have been named as the influencers, for instance, at least one was an Australian citizen. And so how do we, and I'm not saying that these are easy issues, right? When can we start trusting somebody? So if there's a Chinese Australian, I was born in Australia and my parents are from Hong Kong, but say there was an Australian who was born in China and came here when they were, you know, a very young child. At what point can you trust, or can we trust this person that they're not a foreign agent? And I guess my central argument in this is, if we are seeking to defend Australian values, then we need to have confidence in those values. And we need to approach this from the perspective of trust. Because if you approach it the other way, you're actually doing it the authoritarian way. Right. If you approach it from distrust, you go, we're going to shut down debate. We're going to treat people as spies. You know, we're going to do this dob in a foreigner kind of thing. You know, and if we're true to our values, I don't think that's the way we should approach it.
Okay, we'll come back to that issue. Marie, you, as the part of Vision Times, a Chinese language media group, in some respects are on the front line of this, if one follows the research into this issue in Australia, particularly by John Fitzgerald down in Melbourne, who's chronicled how just about all of the Chinese language media groups in Australia have started, when they talk about issues in China, in the PRC, now basically adopt their language and follow, you know, as if it were dictated by the propaganda ministry in Beijing. Now, this issue of covert influence. I've heard, can you give us an example of your group, what kind of pressure your group came under to do exactly the same thing?
Okay, yeah. I just wanted to say that, you know, 20 to 30 years ago, probably all the Chinese language media in Australia are very much like ours. You know, start off, you can be a little bit left, a little bit right, but you're pretty much independent. But, you know, fast forward to today, we are quite special. So, you know, and the local, like the local Chinese media is very, very important in influencing and shaping the perspectives of the Chinese community. I know that some people say, you know, you've got a lot of internationally based Chinese media groups that also have, you know, quite independent, give you quite good news coverage, but a lot of it is focused on international news. There's really a huge lack of independent Chinese Australia related, like relations related reporting. So you know, and also the Chinese language media here, we are really facing a lot of pressures that are not faced by other ethnic medias like the Korean newspapers or the Vietnamese newspapers. So just some examples, because we still have a business to run, so I can't give anything very specific, but I actually have given very detailed cases to the parliamentary committee, but I've
I heard you give a very specific example on ABC Radio, so why don't you repeat that?
Yeah, that particular example. We have a migration agent who has an office both here in Australia and also in Beijing. He is actually very close to us, like he's been doing ads with us for quite a few years, but since he's had his Beijing office, about a couple of weeks before he pulled his ad contract from our newspaper, the state securities, the Chinese State Bureau, was actually camping in his office for about 2 weeks, constantly harassing him to the point where, you know, he couldn't really do much work.
To stop him advertising in your paper.
Yeah, exactly, in our paper, in Australia, all the way here in Australia. So he ended up pulling that, but you know, he was very good friends actually with our director. He said, "I'm really sorry, you know, I have to pull the ads from both your Melbourne paper and the Sydney paper because this is, you know, it's the sort of pressure that I've been facing." And also we get some of our advertisers have also been called into the Chinese consulate. I won't say which one, but was grilled for 3 hours for a tea chat in Australia, throughout Australia. It's quite a few. For a little tea chat for 3 hours. And she was told not to tell anyone, but she did tell our sales, who has a very good, close, you know, relationship with her. So we actually, you know, can't really release a name or anything, but basically that's exactly what happened to her. And she was forced to pull the ads. And these are quite sizable Chinese companies that have a lot of government connections within China, and that's where they get the business from.
I mean, I don't want to sound naive, but if the papers, the content of the other papers becomes standardized, I mean, we all know that people don't buy the People's Daily in China to read it. It's a kind of you have to subscribe to it. So if the content has been sort of bastardized in many of the other newspaper groups, don't they suffer commercially for that?
Yeah, exactly. They suffer commercially, but you get the state funding.
So they get advertising.
So you get the state contracts. You get those kind of contracts. So it's not which is why a lot of newspapers and also a lot of media and website platforms, you see a sort of a decrease in the quality of the articles because you don't really need to engage that much with the readers anymore because you've got this steady funding coming through. Yeah, so which is why for us, we have to work extra hard at creating a lot of different platforms under different names and also, trying to engage with our readers and work extra hard for that. Yeah, and which is why, I just wanted to touch on, maybe we can do that later.
What do you want to touch on?
I want to touch on something said.
Just come back to that.
Maybe we'll come back to that.
Su Lin, I'm going to bring you in now. I mean, I noticed coming back to Australia reading some of Su Lin's article, which had a lot of anger in them, I've got to say, or edge, I should say, rather than anger. And just let me give you a quote, and this is in response to that this debate generally. Like, some Australians seem to have a problem understanding Chinese Australians are Australians. So just as I've learned to fend off racist questions, I now have to arm myself with a fresh set of retorts with the inevitable inquiries, are you a spy or are you a member of the Chinese Communist Party? Now, do people really say that, or are they this just clunky Aussie humour?
Well, when I was, here's an example. I go to, I go to a pub and I'll say, oh, look, what do you do? I said, I'm a journalist. And the first thing they'll say is, so how's that working out for you, the English? And so my whole life growing up in Australia, I get that question. And then I'll often get, so are you from Thailand? Do you work in, the Thai industries? And there's always these sort of, you know, peppering of answers or questions around my background. So recently, after the whole spy debate, a few of my Chinese migrant friends, they work in newspapers, they work in media groups, advertising companies, and they said some reporters have written to them with a whole list of questions around their allegiance to China and what they were doing, where they were working before, whereabouts in China did they live, and what sort of, you know, associations they had with China. So it was funny. So, and then funnily enough, after that, I was at a pub and someone said, oh, are you part of the Chinese Communist Party? I'm sorry, my family's from Malaysia and Singapore. You do realize those are Commonwealth countries. So I have a Chinese background, but my father was a bit of an Anglophile. So he was stunned by that. So there's these questions starting to percolate around my association with the Chinese Communist Party. I'm a Chinese diaspora out of mainland China, and my forefathers are from there. But I also grew up in a very British system. So my connection with the Chinese Communist Party is zero, hence the story in the column.
Yeah, I guess that's reprehensible. But I guess one of the issues in this debate, and we were discussing this backstage, is that if you go to China, for example, and you say, no, I'm Australian, we know the sort of strain within the Communist Party in China, which says, no, you're all Chinese, one blood. So, I mean, how do you, I'm sure you can see it from both sides. How do you think about that then, if you're getting it both ways?
So I represent the people's voice. So I work with a lot of Chinese business people, the community, migrants. I mean, I don't do a lot of the policy stuff. I report from the ground. Exactly. So I speak fluent Mandarin, as being Singaporean schooled. So I speak to a lot of these business people and some very contentious, controversial business people in Mandarin. So I hear what they have to say. And similarly, they hear what I have to say. And interestingly enough, they know of my Chinese background. They also know I'm foreign, in that I always say I'm Australian first. And they never push upon that sort of, they don't go, oh, you're Chinese and therefore you have to support us. They also know that I'm also slightly different, in that I'm Chinese, Singaporean, Malaysian Chinese, and then Australian Chinese. And so there is not much of that, oh, you have to be one of us. I don't feel that pressure from them. Though, of course, it's easier for them to communicate with me because I speak the language, you know, as they transition from Mandarin to speaking English in Australia, and some of them find it harder than others. There is that sort of that camaraderie that they've formed, you know, rather than a, oh, you have to be one of us.
Right. There's not betrayal if you get a bad story.
Oh, no.
So, look, one of the big overarching issue, I think, hanging over this debate is that, and to quote something that somebody wrote recently, the Chinese Communist Party is a very different sort of political organisation. We're used to Australia having a sort of whole-of-government approach. Actually, we're lucky if we get whole-of-government. China is more sort of whole-of-government and whole-of-society. So it's difficult to handle. And if you collapse the categories of Chinese Communist Party into China and the Chinese people into a single organic whole, then it's hard to disentangle them when you're dealing with it politically. So to start with you, Adam, on this, and others can come in, by the way, as well now, how do you disentangle that in a way where you know, you can have this discussion and it doesn't end up with, you know, accusations flying either which way of racism.
Right. So, I mean, I think the first thing that we need to do is to be really clear about the terminology, right? So when we talk about China today, we mostly talk about the People's Republic of China. There's other Chinas out there, the greatest Sinosphere, that is beyond just the People's Republic of China. That includes Chinese diasporas all around the world, from San Francisco to Sydney, from Indonesia, Vietnam, to Africa. So we have to be very clear that the China that we are engaging with, when we talk about China as a country, and the Sinosphere, the greater Chinese culture, tradition, and groups that we're dealing with. So I think that's an important thing. So it's not Chinese influence, because that sounds like the influence of ethnic Chinese people. Rather, it's China's influence, or in this specific case, the influence of the Communist Party of China. Right, so I think we have to be very clear about...
It's hard to get that in the headline, isn't it? Chinese party state sort of, you know...
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, yeah. Sometimes the nuance is lost to save space, but I think it's quite important that terminology, Chinese, China, the Communist Party, and to understand that the idea of Chineseness is very rich, right? There's whole... You can identify with Australia, you know, other countries that you've migrated to, as well as a kind of Chinese identity that's not constricted by the narratives put forward by the Communist Party. So the Communist Party would like to tell a particular story and to define Chineseness in such a way that suits its agendas and political objectives. And I think we should not fall into the trap of that.
So anybody else want to come in on that, Jason?
Agree what Adam just said. I just think there's more layers of complexity as well. I think it's very common to think of China as a big monolithic sort of whole, or even the Communist Party as a big monolithic whole. There was a really interesting piece by David Kelly from China Policy, where he says, look, there's not one China. There's actually five or six different Chinas, and they come out in different situations, and he has names for these. I'm trying to remember what they are. So one is what he calls a self-sufficient civilization, which is this whole civilizational view that Adam talked about, the thousand years of history, the notion of Zhonghua, which is the, you know, the civilizational view of China.
I think we're up to 5,000 or 6,000 years now, aren't we, from memory? Yeah.
Right.
It's going up.
You know, then there's another view of China, which he calls the sovereign survivor, which is the Communist Party, you know, the sovereign state. And that will behave a certain way in different situations. And then on the positive side, there's this other China, which he calls the herald of the high frontier. Now, this is the China that aspires to be a global leader. This is the China that puts in place anti-piracy operations, scientific research in Antarctica, tries to fill the void where the US is pulling back. And so his argument is you can't look at China as just one monolithic whole. There are actually lots of different shades to it within the complexity that is China domestically, but China in the world. And with that nuanced dissection of China, if there's any way that can make itself into the public debate, I think we'd have a more sort of engaged and more nuanced argument.
Right?
I totally agree with that. And I just wanted to remind everyone that communism actually was not from China. So it is actually for the Chinese. It's an imported thing into China. So actually, the way that the Communist Party is behaving at the moment in China and also overseas, exerting its interference and influence, is actually very un-Chinese. I've actually heard now two people actually mention that to me. I thought, oh, it's a quite good term to call it. It is actually very un-Chinese because, you know, the Chinese civilization has been around for all these thousands of years, and then you've got the Communist Party over at the moment. But just one thing to remember is that actually, a lot of the Chinese media differentiates this quite well between China, when they talk about China, and when they talk about the Chinese Communist Party. But I think a lot of the Western media, because now that we're starting to discuss this issue, they seem to conflate that a little bit. But the Chinese media, a lot of it actually does it well. But for some independent media, it's quite good. For some others that actually toe the state line, they actually use that to their advantage. So when you're supposed to say the Chinese Communist Party, they actually say China. So I had one example where one Chinese writer actually sent an article to an editor of a particular Chinese language newspaper here in Australia. The editor changed his in his article, every single place where he said the Chinese Communist Party, he changed it to China. So it doesn't sound like he's criticizing the Communist Party. It sounds like the article's sort of criticizing China, which is actually a bit more suitable for the Chinese Communist Party. Because if you're criticizing China, then people think, oh, this particular writer's being, you know, racist, or he's being pro-democracy, or he's being anti-China. So they can just label that onto him. But in actual fact, he was actually quite upset afterwards, and yeah, that they actually changed it.
It's a simple logic, isn't it? I mean, the country's government is quite different from the people. I mean, I tell you what, I mean, I meet lots and lots of all my Chinese migrants. I talk to them, the business people who come here, those who, you know, have come on a migrant visa, and they are just absolutely normal, average people. In fact, I would say they are less communistic than, say, Chinese in Singapore and Malaysia, for example, who are very authoritarian, and they, you know, there's that schooling, that toughness, whereas I find Chinese parents very relaxed, actually, about their kids. In fact, here's all this money and enjoy yourselves, you know. So, I mean, you know, to really then say that there is that communism in the heart of every Chinese migrant coming here, or every Chinese for that matter, is a very dangerous thing to say. And then it falls back onto the Chinese Australians, which is I consider myself. I love my heritage, my cultural background, and all the richness that it brings to Australia. But I also can identify as an Australian. And my problem is that all of this discourse serves to actually then put us all into one category, which is very dangerous to Jason's point.
Well, I guess one of the big issues here, obviously, is the hard-headed political issue. I've no doubt that the party in Beijing would like, you know, Australians to internalise their political values and to wipe out any sort of opponents of theirs here. It's nothing surprising about that. But does their approach work? Maybe Australia is a bit of a testing ground for that, because we do have a very large Chinese community with a, you know, relatively speaking. Does it work? Particularly in a country like Australia, which I hear a lot of people say, I wish this debate had more nuance. Of course, we wish that. We don't do nuance very well. But does the Chinese approach work, or are they finding out that perhaps it doesn't? Does anybody have any comment on that?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, my analysis will come from historical examples where, you know, the Chinese Communist Party won power in China, not because of military brilliance, or initial political power, but because of its ability to co-opt groups and to conduct covert operations through what's known as United Front operations. So these are basically shadowy operations to gain support among sympathizers and to sow dissent within the camp of the KMT, so the Nationalists, joined Chinese Civil War. And that was instrumental for the Chinese Communist victory in mainland China. So the United Front hasn't been as important since 1949, but since the advent of Xi to supreme power, he has elevated the United Front to be one of the magical weapons, right? In addition to party ideology and military struggle. So one of the three most powerful tools in the toolkit of the Communist Party of China. And as China becomes more powerful, it is seeking to conduct these operations overseas, regionally, even in Australia. Most recently, we had governmental changes where the propaganda system was consolidated and the voice of China, ironically, was created to project China's voice and tell its story to the world.
That's a radio station, global radio station, like Voice of America.
That's right, that's yep. right. But in addition to that, the United Front has acquired a status, the highest status it's acquired since 1949, just telling you how important Xi Jinping puts on the operations of this organization.
Anybody else? Does it work?
No, just one. Yeah.
Oh.
Go.
You go then.
Just want to quickly say that it's actually already working, which I think, because at the moment, look, all these critical reports are coming up. Of course, you know, people saying, oh, you're being racist because you're talking about China instead of CCP and all that. But, I mean, the Four Corners report, it has actually found, you know, these allegations of the acts of interference, and plus all these other news reports prior to Four Corners and also post. You can see all these actual things that are happening. But instead of the Chinese government, instead of saying, oh, you know, this, your allegations are wrong, or, you know, this, I can prove, you know, we have not done this, they've actually said to the Australian, well, they've actually, you know, broadcasted that we will make sure they will, they're telling the Chinese people that it is actually very dangerous in Australia. Do not come and
Public response. I mean, there's been a massive backlash, and it's kind of spreading overseas. So I just wonder whether they are.
Well, I think they're suppressing.
They say one thing in public, one in private. I wonder about that.
One thing in private. Yeah. Well,
they're always going to be.
Their public response is, you know, saying, you know, we're going to reduce the number of students that are coming here. This is already that sort of like threats and consequences that Australia will face. Economically, well, there will be a slight economic backlash. I don't know if it will be real or not, but this is something that I think China is prepared to take. It's a stance that they're prepared to take if this thing continues.
It's kind of what countries do as well, right? So I think there's a few questions that ask. So one is, what proportion of the activities that the Chinese Communist Party takes goes beyond the customary exercise of statecraft or sovereignty?
Diplomacy, spying, everything.
Yeah. What's that bit that goes beyond that and is unacceptable? Question one. Question two. That goes beyond, realistically looking at it, what is the level of threat to our institutions? And it goes back to this point, my opening point about confidence. Are we so lacking in confidence in our own institutions that we feel that these things will destroy them? Not to say that they should be tolerated. Absolutely not. They should be dealt with. But what is the overall approach that we take to this? And to this question, is it working? You know, Chinese political influence. To me, what works? What has worked? We had a perfectly fine policy on climate change that was turned through influence. Riders who take a ride on Uber pay a tax on every ride. That's influence. The mining industry spent $22 million adjusting the terms of the mining tax. That's influence.
That's all domestic influence, is it not?
It's domestic influence, yes, but that is influence because it has been successful in turning over a national important policy. When we think about China, what's happened here, there have been clumsy attempts at sort of donations. There is pressure exerted on Chinese media organizations. There is a certain amount of covert activity, of course, and these things should be dealt with, and they are unacceptable. But I think with proper perspective, what is the realistic likelihood that these things, by the rhetoric that's being used, will destroy our democracy? That's what I would take issue with.
Yeah, I guess in some ways there's no nice way of pushing back. That's, you know, we may come out of this and things may be much better. Both sides may have made their point. But in the early stages of a debate like this, particularly when we're having to deal with a very different political system at a turning point in our regional power structure, an epochal one in the case of Australia, it's all mixed up with that as well, is it not? You know, it's not just about China, it's about China, it's about America, it's that as well. Does that make it all that much difficult?
Yeah, can I just go back to Jason's point about whether the Chinese Communist Party influence, or what do they actually have influence and have they been successful? So the examples that you give are obviously ways that corporations can influence public policy. So in the case of the Communist Party, I think it's much more complicated than that. It's much more longer term. And the influence is not just in certain policy changes that you can see at point A, but it's in the evolution of how we engage with the People's Republic of China, right? So one example is, do we speak out when the Chinese Communist Party does something wrong on the international stage? For example, the violation of international law. Do we speak out when domestically it conducts human rights violations? Do we stand up for these values, which are also our interests, which animate this country? And if not, why not over time, right? So my concern is that, yes, we can say, you know, the Chinese Communist Party have not changed these range of policy, Australian policies. But I think over time, it'll have a cumulative effect that'll negatively impact our ability to make independent policy, as well as to erode Australians' institutions and values. So in effect, over time, changing who we are as a people.
It's more how you speak out. Mm-hmm. If you disagree with somebody, even in your normal sort of personal relationships, if you disagree with somebody, most, you know, if you're emotionally intelligent about it, you pick the right way to say it, you know, and often that's more effective rather than just blowing everything, you know, blowing everything up.
And that's what we celebrate about being Australians, in that we are able to celebrate a democracy and voice our opinions and be assertive about points that affect us or don't affect us. So for example, Clive Hamilton's book, and I'm sorry to bring that into the discussion, but the other day there was a discussion about, Clive Hamilton's doing, he's not defending, you know, he's not being racist. He's in fact defending or looking after the Chinese here who want to be looked after, you know, the dissidents against China. And I say, isn't that a bit interfering? Who asked you to defend these people? I don't want it to be defended by Clive Hamilton. That's not democratic. First of all, I have no links to the CCP. And so why are you standing up for the entire group of Chinese Australians or Chinese in Australia? And that doesn't make sense, because that goes against the fundamental pillars of democracy.
There is something.
Sorry. You want to comment on that about...
I just want to comment a little bit early, before Clive Hamilton, about when you criticize the government.
By the way, everybody's quite welcome to talk about Clive Hamilton. No,
I have a lot to say
that.
About it too. But when you criticize if you criticize the Chinese government, the sort of reaction you get is very different when you criticize the US government. I think that's the key difference here.
Well, I think he makes that point. I mean, nobody, you know, would any publisher in Australia care about publishing an anti-American book? No way.
Yeah,
in
exactly.
fact, it might be a selling point.
Yeah, and I'm sure if you criticize, you have a go at Trump and the US government, the US isn't going to say, oh, we're going to reduce the number of tourists to Australia, or we're going to stop the number of students coming here, reduce the number of students. So just the reactions are very different. And to Clive Hamilton's book as well. I know he's, you know, a lot of the stories that he, a lot of the examples that he gave in there, we actually, as a Chinese newspaper, for years we've been receiving letters and stories from these kind of people.
I think you're in the book, aren't you? Your company's in
the book.
I know.
I was actually quite surprised. I saw myself in the acknowledgement page. I was like, oh my God, am I there? I think I spoke to him for about 2 minutes on the phone.
Well, the average Chinese punter on the street that I talk to, they'll always say, why is there such a fear of the Far East? What is it about Asia or China or the Far East that's so scary? I report, I have a second round at the AFR, I write about property. So the foreign investment that the US has is still number one ahead of China in total dollars. So that influence, isn't that greater than Chinese influence? And yet no one's going, ooh, we're so scared about Americans. God, you know, the Americans are over there. Look at those COVID, you know, activities they're up to. But yet, is it because the features are so obvious that we are, you know, openly different?
I don't think it's the features. I think it's the way that the Chinese government likes to suppress dissent. That's the problem. I think that's the issue that everyone has.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
bring up the point that communism isn't the Chinese concept.
Yeah,
so.
But a lot of Chinese people actually don't know that.
Yes, right.
Like, yeah, even, you know, I know we all pretty much grew up here. We're quite clear with the difference between the country and the government. But if you ask someone who actually grew up in China, they might not, some of them might be okay, but some of them might not have that kind of clear concept. So a lot of Chinese actually think, oh, you know, because we've been governed by the Communist Party for so many years now, for quite a few generations, then you kind of forget that fact that the Communist Party does not equal to China. So a lot of the more independent newspapers, we try to point that out quite often, that the Chinese government does not equal to China. But even that, because the Chinese culture is you have to save face. So even if you have an argument, you keep it indoors. Yes. So even if the government, is, you know, we don't like the government, you know, we still have to keep quiet because we don't want to be embarrassing ourselves on the international stage. So that's the way the Chinese culture kind of makes.
So Jason, we'll hear from you, then we'll go to questions.
So three quick points. I mean, we can't control what China does within its own borders. That's a legitimate exercise of Chinese sovereignty. Right? So where China censors things, you know, there's not much that we can do about that. But the difficulty is with globalization now, we're talking about extraterritoriality. So to what extent does China try to exercise control outside of its territories and how do we deal with that? That's the first point. To Clive, and this is an example of, you know, how you say things and what things, you know, when you put things out there, understanding the effect that it has. So there's a paragraph in Clive's book where he goes, there are now about 15,000 spies or informants, Chinese spies or informants in Australia. Now, he's just trying to point out a fact, right? And it might well be a fact. I didn't look at the footnote. But when you say that, imagine what that does. It's 15,000, you know, and you look around. Are you one of them?
Maybe.
You know, are you one of them? You know, there's 15,000 of them amongst us. Do you think, what is this? You know, what does this do, you know, in terms of suspicion and distrust? The last point goes to this point about helping Chinese people. A senior journalist that I won't name broke one of the seminal stories around this, and I rang him up and I said, mate, what in the world are you thinking? And he, highly intelligent, massively respected journalist, he and I agree on probably 90% of things. On this, the conversation was really like Aristotle versus Confucius. It was just, we're in different universes. And this friend of mine, and he's a good friend, said, we need to do this because the victims of this are Chinese people in Australia. And so this was a just war from his. So I guess the point that I'm trying to make, there is no good or evil, bad or, you know, this the complexity of this debate, people will come at this with absolutely the right intentions. What is necessary is somehow an ability to unpack the complexity in this debate such that we achieve the right outcomes as a country, we look after our national interest, we don't disenfranchise a really important part of the Australian community, and we don't blow up the relationship, which objectively speaking is a really important relationship for Australia.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to go to questions now.
Laurie Smith, I'm involved with the Australia-China Business Council and also China Matters. The Prime Minister, when he talked about the introduction of this legislation, was pretty explicit about what one of the drivers was behind it, really pointing quite clearly at China. But have the security and intelligence agencies been as explicit as they might about what are the practical, the actual concerns and cases that have driven some of this activity at the government? Or have we seen too much of a drip of leaks into the media that's not very clearly attributed and actually a little bit hazy and smoky?
Well, we need somebody with insight into the intelligence briefs. Adam, you're in Canberra. Physically, why don't you give that a go?
Well, I mean, I think obviously Chinese interference is one of the important considerations for the current debate about the legislations. But obviously there are other interference as well. So I think the criteria should be what harms Australia's interests, right? Whether that be from Israel or Japan or North Korea or China. So I think for me, one of the things that's different about China is that it's hugely important to us and it's growing, its power is growing very rapidly and has the international ambitions to achieve its international goals of becoming an international superpower.
But you don't really know whether there's a little black box in Canberra which has all this stuff.
I haven't seen it personally.
Okay, so let's try it. the front.
Michael Ahrens, so I was with Transparency International until recently. Your Jason's very first point about the need for approaching it as trust and with a little bit of knowledge and recognising Australians don't handle nuance. I mean, but it really struck me the importance of this when I saw the draft legislation that came out at the end of last year about foreign donations, which is where they tried to extend it right across to all the charities. Even the Catholic Church was opposed to the silly draft they brought out. But are you, what's the level of confidence you have that, particularly in Canberra, that they're able to really handle this discussion when they know so little about China, most of them?
I think that there are difficulties with the administration of the legislation, and I don't know that it's going to be effective, because the way it's drafted at the moment, you can actually have a foreign entity make a donation through a, you know, through a citizen or a domestic entity. Personally, I think all political donations should be banned or capped. You know, in some ways that would do more in terms of, you know, removing the problem. But to the heart of your question, which is, is there a sufficient knowledge in Canberra to deal with? I would hope that we can make, you know, the understanding, not just China, but just Asia generally, much more of a priority across the Australian community, so that we can have sort of deeper conversations about this. And most importantly, that it doesn't turn into populism, because these debates, all of these debates, are too important to surrender to populism.
Anthony Bibelow from Nous Group. It's already clear that the government is going to place a significant effort into kind of countering foreign interference, and that's going to continue. What do you think government should be doing in addition to that, alongside that, to ensure that its relationship with Australia's Chinese community and the Chinese community's relationship with the broader society isn't collateral damage in that effort?
As you may know, that a couple of days ago, or was it early last week, that the Australian government set up a task force in the Home Affairs Department to address this issue of foreign interference. And one of the things that they're very conscious about is engagement with diaspora communities. So obviously in this case, in the context of this debate, Chinese communities. So I think there's a much greater awareness of the need to engage with and understand the complexity of the Chinese Australian community. So the question is whether the government is willing to put in the resources, and I think it's going to take time to build up that goodwill with the communities. It's so Australian Chinese communities instead of a community, because I think they come from all very different backgrounds to be a coherent community. So I think it's something that we have to wait.
Anybody else got a comment about that?
No? I just wanted to add a little bit on that. Look, a lot of this sort of damage that's coming, it's happening within the Chinese communities, is a lot of it is coming from the Chinese media. It's the way the Chinese media is framing these sort
the
of discussions. No, the media here.
Chinese language media in
Australia. It's the way that they're framing these sort of discussions, where they're saying, this is actually against China, Australia is being anti-China, is being racist. So it's this sort of alliance that I really, because look, a lot of the Chinese Australians here, I mean, probably all of us here on the panel, we're okay. We grew up here. Probably our first point of news is the English websites. But for a lot of the Chinese people here, you're more used to reading Chinese. You go to WeChat for your news. You go to the Chinese language newspapers or the websites. Like everything, it's a lot better in Chinese. It's just more convenient for them. But the things you read are these things about, you know, this really exaggerated reporting. And this sort of thing is really damaging the relationship between the Australian government and the Chinese community.
I was going to say, we had an experience of that the other day here, when I think Australia has all manner of garden variety anti-dumping actions, but the Chinese media portrayed it as Australia joins Trump in you know, bashing China, blah, blah. Anyway, sorry, you too.
Very good example.
Yeah.
I think that there's a role that the mainstream can play here and this. I mean, it's interesting that, I mean, you'd imagine that most Chinese people, when they come here, whether they're tourists or they come here to live, they want to read independent press. They don't want to read censored sort of media. So then there's a question of what are our mainstream media organisations doing in terms of making sure that the core content is in Chinese, not just in Chinese, but in a form that's interesting and accessible, in a form that Chinese people like to read. And if it's not there, then where else are they going to go, you know, for their news? And I was having noodles today with a Chinese friend who's just come on holiday, and she was just flipping through her sort of WeChat news. And this is a comment. She said, "Oh, I'm so sick of seeing Xi Jinping. It's Xi Jinping again." You know, so I thought this was just quite funny. You know, that this was just a regular Chinese person reading, you know, the news that she's used to reading. So, but not just across the media. This also goes into politics and leadership. And in some ways, you know, if we talk about the influence of the Chinese Communist Party, in respect of Chinese people here, and if it is in some way a battle of values, right, then we need to put our best foot forward, and we need to give the Chinese who come here, because they come here for a reason, right, we need to give Chinese who come here a real sense of belonging, and that they can be part of this place, and that they can contribute to this place, and go somewhere with this place, because if they don't, then maybe that'll increase the attractiveness of the Chinese Communist Party.
So then,
and of course, those who do come here, obviously, and I say to the lots of community, the community I talk to is, you also have to participate, as, you know, if you're coming here to migrate to Australia, this is your country, and so participate. And they are trying to. But to your point about Asian media, Western media too has a big part to play in this. The Telegraph puts out, you know, when the census information came out, the front page was Chinatown. Our media, not just the Chinese one, but the Western media too, has a role to play in education, in guiding, in forming these alliances with our communities, whether it's Chinese, Australian, or other communities. So it's part of that, you know, here's the information. This is the right facts to go with. And we need to do that, as you said, Jason, to put our best foot forward and offer that the right information rather than a biased information, or one that tells everybody, oh, if you're, you know, you're Asian, something's wrong with you, or, you know, you ought to be, you know, suspected of spying. So I think that's where the voice or the education from the Western media too has a part to play in that.
Thanks. Peter, up the back.
Thanks, Richard. Peter Harcher from the Sydney Morning Herald, not the Daily Telegraph. Again, your comment, Jason, about Australia needs to approach this from a position of trust. You mentioned a couple of examples where trust was broken. One example you mentioned was the use or attempted use of political donations to change political party policies towards mainland China. Another example you mentioned was Chinese Communist Party pressure on Chinese language media in Australia. If they are not sufficient breaches of trust to generate a foreign interference bill, what is the red line that you would draw to justify a piece of legislation such as the foreign interference bill that we now see before the House?
Peter, I think you've misunderstood me. I support the foreign interference bill. I think it should be there. My point about trust is, yes, where trust is broken, if there is covert or unacceptable behaviour, it must be dealt with. My point was more about what is our mindset that we take to Chinese Australians here, and what is the mindset that we take into the relationship? Because if we approach at a fundamental level the relationship from the perspective of suspicion and distrust, it's a downward spiral and it won't lead us anywhere good. We have to approach things from the perspective of confidence and trust, not suspicion. And only then can we improve where that relationship's at. That was the crux of my point.
Why don't we get two questions now from both of you?
Adam, I agree that China has gone backwards under the current president, but I think Australia has also gone backwards under the current government.
in some ways. I just wonder whether it's we may be disproportionately focusing on, you know, the China's influence, whereas you know, the British government and the, maybe the South African communities have exerted great influence on Australia's foreign policy just recently, but we don't seem to be talking so much about them. I just wonder whether this kind of Cold War mentality benefit Australia in the long run, since, you know, China is the biggest trading partner with Australia.
Okay, and let's get the one down in front, and then we'll get both the questions answered at the same time.
Hi, thanks. Great discussion. Jonathan Ping from Bond University. So I'm an associate professor, and I'm interested in all the nuances. And Adam, you said a reset. So what would that be? What would the reset actually be? And you've been slightly negative about the party. Are there any positives? I'm thinking economic growth and lifting millions of people from poverty and 150 plus thousand students every year. Are there any positives? If there aren't any positives and we're thinking long term, does it mean either no Communist Party in China or no democracy in Australia?
I guess one of the first things is that I don't know what the counterfactuals are, whether if the Communist Party of today was very different, if the late 80s had produced a different variant of the Communist Party, whether we still see the millions and millions lifted out of poverty and the economic development, etc. So I don't have any counterfactuals, so I don't know. But I think for me, the growth of Chinese power raises some very important questions for Australia, its role, its relationship with China, its role in the world even, right? So my calculus would be a very realist one, one that says, what in this debate, what are the influence and interference activities that most harm Australia's national interest? And to address these, right? And, you know, I'm not a policymaker, so I don't know exactly how exactly you would match policies to devise a strategy. But obviously, you've got to be cognizant of the costs, that the Chinese Communist Party can bring bear onto Australia in terms of trade, in terms of, you know, tourism and the students. So it has a lot of leverages. So if we are to push back, then we need to be very conscious, then Canberra need to be very conscious of what are the harms?
What are the costs to us?
What are the costs? And is it worth it? So it's a very realist and strategic calculus that policymakers and political leaders need to make, and I don't have a clear answer for you on that.
And I guess that also, you also answering the first question there, I mean, that was a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, you made a good point about why don't we focus on other countries, right? So, again, I'll go back to the fact that in some cases the other countries have different political systems. So for me, that makes a big difference. The actor cannot be distinct from the action. You know, if one actor had a history of crime, so bad analogy, but if one actor had a history of crime, the other one didn't and was a really upstanding community member, you know, if both of them held a gun, how would you feel? That's the analogy. That's a simple analogy I'll make. So the internal constitution of a political system is going to be reflected in how it deals with other countries in the international stage.
I think we're going to have another session on the South African farmer influence operations. but that has not been very covert, I would say. Jason, you can finish off, please.
Just quick, I don't think the panel is saying that, you know, everything's bad about the Communist Party. I don't think that's...
It's not a discussion about the economy anyway.
Yeah, and it's not an economic... but to that point, I mean, one thing that I admire about the way China does things is that it actually does national long-term strategic planning. Imagine if we had that in Australia. that's something that's the way they build infrastructure, you know, national infrastructure, the speed and the efficiency with which that is built, You know, there are some things to admire, but bear in mind that it's not a democracy, so things just sort of get done, you know, without opposition.
Let's not forget there is 1.4, 1.5 billion people to manage. I mean, imagine the democracy of that country, like India, for example. I mean, there's a reason why it's gone that way to a degree.
But I just wanted to go back to this, the rise of China and the place of, you know, in the world, I guess. And I've had a particular view about this for a while when, ages and ages ago, when I was in The Hague with the War Crimes Tribunal, that we dealt a lot with the Chinese sort of diplomats there when we were very young and very, very junior. And I was just in the conversation and this fellow said, I said, look, how do you guys prosecute your foreign policy? And he says, oh, look, it's really simple. We just say no to everything first and then we go away and think about it. and what that told me at the time, and I don't even know if this is true, this was just a dinner conversation, right? What it struck me then is that China is this massive, deep, conservative force in international affairs. Right? It's like steering a tanker ship through the water. And when we come out of a unipolar world where you have the United States as the single superpower, and particularly if we look at the current president and you know some of the things that have gone on, it is an argument to say it is actually very good for the balance of international relations generally, globally, that there is this ballast, that there is this deeply conservative ballast out there who will just say no to everything to start with and then go away and think about it.
Well, on that note, no. Thanks for the panel very much. I think it was a great discussion, and thanks everybody for coming.